My name is Lauren Galick. I'm the director of criminal justice reform at the Reason Foundation, which is the nonprofit organization that publishes Reason Magazine and Reason TV. We wanted to have this conversation, you know, discuss the myths and the realities of human trafficking in the United States, and as well, in our opinion, the misguided ways in which governments are approaching the issue, and how, you know, many of the ways that governments are approaching this issue is actually contrary to the criminal justice reform that we've been hearing about and seeing lately. So anyway, I want to introduce my panelists. First is Elizabeth Nolan Brown. She is a staff editor for Reason.com, where she covers things like sex policy, criminal justice, reproductive rights, and free speech. Her writing has also appeared in places such as Politico, Playboy, Time, Newsweek, Fox News, The Dish, Libertarianism.org, and The Week. She is the author of the Politico magazine article, America's Newest War, which discusses how legislators are making the same mistakes with sex workers as they did in combating the war on drugs. So next to her right is Katie Hale Jarris. Did I pronounce that right? Close enough? Okay, I get that with my last name too. So she is the research associate at Georgetown University and a PhD candidate in justice, law, and criminology at American University. Her research centers on the intersection of criminal or otherwise socially deviant behavior and public health outcomes. Much of her work involves collaborations with incarcerated communities, sex workers, and harm reduction organizations. She has served as the secretary of the Sex Workers Outreach Project National Board of Directors for over 2 years. During her time with USA, she has spearheaded several advocacy campaigns, most recently organizing around the arrest of 16 massage workers in Honolulu, Hawaii. The women were charged with sexual assault directly related to their interactions with the undercover officers who arrested them. She is also currently serving as the lead editor of the forthcoming Not Just the Alleys, Expanded Perspective on Street-Based Sex Work, an edited volume that brings researchers, policymakers, and people impacted by street-based sex work together in conversation. And then finally, we have Molly Gill. Molly Gill is the Government Affairs Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. FAM is a nonprofit, nonpartisan sentencing reform organization founded in 1991 and located in Washington, D.C. As Government Affairs Counsel, Gill works with policymakers, the media, and the public to advocate for sentencing laws that are cost-effective, fit the crime and the individual, and protect individual liberty and strengthen families and communities. Gill has appeared as an expert on sentencing in numerous print, television, and radio news outlets, and has been published in the Federal Sentencing Reporter. She also serves as a commissioner on the District of Columbia Sentencing and Criminal Code Revision Commission. Prior to coming to FAM in 2007, Gill practiced construction and commercial litigation and assisted with prosecuting homicides, gang crimes, and gun offenses for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So, please welcome our panelists. Okay, so I'm gonna be a little tacky and kind of read off of this sheet of paper to make sure that I ask the questions that I wanna ask. So please forgive me. But before we get started with kind of diving into the subject, I want to first make sure that we're all on the same page as far as these different terms are concerned, because I think that, you know, for a lot of people in the audience, they might not be as up to date or have been following these different pieces of legislation as the panelists up here. So I'm going to ask Liz, can you help differentiate between the following terms: sex trafficking, human trafficking, labor trafficking, and sexual exploitation?
Well, sexual exploitation is just a broad term that people use, which encompasses a lot of things. But human trafficking is a term you often hear when people are talking about this, and human trafficking encompasses both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. We're going to mostly be talking about sex trafficking here tonight because that's what a lot of the focus has been on with the laws and the policing efforts. And sex trafficking is defined as, using force, fraud, or coercion to make someone be engaged in prostitution if they are an adult. If they are under 18, it is sort of de facto defined as sex trafficking. So even if there is no force, fraud, or coercion involved, if someone is in any way involved in a person under 18 selling sex, then they are defined as a trafficker. So that's kind of, in the broadest terms.
Okay. So the reason we're kind of talking about this now is because there's been a lot of media attention on this issue. Just last week I was on a flight to San Diego and I switched to CNN and there was a documentary on about human trafficking narrated by Jada Pinkett Smith. So it's just kind of random, but it just kind of shows just how, many celebrities, when celebrities are starting to get involved with the cause, that's when you got to start paying attention, right? So it just seems like either this is a new phenomena or there's been way more attention paid to it than has been in recent years. So there's a lot of alarming statistics that are out there that suggest that this is a serious problem that needs to be dealt with. So I'm going to quote here. Representative Joyce Beatty from Ohio declared, and she's a Democrat, declared in a May statement that, quote, in the U.S., some 300,000 children are at risk each year for commercial sexual exploitation. And then similarly, Representative Ann Wagner, who's a Republican from Missouri, said at a congressional hearing, she made a similar statement at a congressional hearing, and she claimed that the stat came from the Department of Justice. The New York Times has also attributed this statistic to the Department of Justice, and Fox News has raised that number to 400,000 and has cited it came from the Health and Human Services Department. So I wanted to ask Liz, since you've written on this issue before, and there's her Politico magazine piece is out in, at registration if you guys want to pick it up, can you highlight some of the statistics that have been used to justify these new laws and like where are they coming from? Is there any truth to them? Like just talk about that for a little bit.
Sure. So there's a lot of really bad numbers out there floating around. And part of the problem is that it's hard to find good numbers on things that are black markets. But it's also that there are a lot of different definitions of trafficking and the way different countries, the way different states, the way different counties define them, it all contributes to an inflating of statistics. But the 300,000 number is one that's repeated all the time, or sometimes it'll see people say hundreds of thousands of children are being trafficked in the United States. And it's one of the most cited numbers I see. And Glenn Kessler at the Washington Post, he's their fact checker columnist. He actually really did a good sort of thorough debunking of that number in particular recently, where he, called all the different people who had cited it, all the different Congress people, and asked them where they got it from. And yeah, they all cited DHS or FBI. So then he called them. Ultimately, it was none of them. They traced it back to a 1991 study by a man named Richard Estes, who it was a non-peer-reviewed study. And he now disassociates himself from it. He says he doesn't want to, it's not a good research study and he doesn't want to be a part of it anymore. There's a few years ago, a report came out from the Crimes Against Children Research Center, which is a really prestigious and sort of, nonpartisan research center that works on these things. And they said in all capitals in their report that they put out, please do not cite these numbers. The reality is we do not know how many juveniles are being involved in prostitution. Credible numbers do not exist. So despite the fact that's everywhere, it's pretty much, Also, I just want to say that the at-risk, the way he did this study was he came up with a series of criteria, such as if you were living in public housing, or if you were a runaway, or any number of things, sort of broad criteria like that, and just assumed that those were things that put people at risk of being trafficked. So even within this number, it's just sort of a broad guesstimate and... And if you poke almost any of the numbers that people are constantly citing out there about sex trafficking, you will kind of come up with the same sort of thing. I just want to read you one more thing about the State Department's numbers on sex trafficking, which you also hear people quote frequently. But actually, the Government Accountability Office took a look into them, and they said that the figures were questionable due to methodological weaknesses, gaps in data, numerical discrepancies, and the fact that they were compiled by one person who did not document his work. So this is kind of what we're looking at here.
That wouldn't even survive college level standards of you'd get kicked out of college for like submitting a paper like that, yeah. right? Or something like that.
So, and there's also just, yeah, so I think that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, despite all that, you know, there has been this kind of push for new legislation to kind of target the issue of human trafficking, sex trafficking. Most recently, you know, there was a federal piece of legislation called the Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act, passed with bipartisan support. And, you know, Molly, I was just hoping that you could explain some of the new crimes that were created under this piece of legislation, and including ones that pass, or that include mandatory minimums, which you are all too familiar with.
Sure. Well, FAM, just for those who aren't familiar, FAM's a nonpartisan organization working on reforming mandatory minimum sentencing laws. For those of you who think that has something to do with the minimum wage, basically these are one-size-fits-all sentencing laws. If you commit X crime, you get at least Y number of years in prison, and judges aren't permitted to consider any other facts of the case, any other mitigating circumstances. There are very few exceptions often to these laws, and sometimes no exceptions at all. So over 200 mandatory minimum sentencing laws exist in the federal code, and they do tend to increase. So that we've been working against those laws, not because we think everything bad should be legal, but because we think that judges are in the best position to judge individual defendants and determine what the appropriate punishment is in every case, and because we sort of fundamentally believe that one-size-fits-all government policies usually tend to not fit a lot of people and produce a lot of absurd circumstances and consequences that can be very harmful and also very expensive. We have been keeping an eye on the sex trafficking. The bill that passed this year was S-178, the Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act. And it actually it took an existing mandatory minimum sentencing law and expanded the conduct. And the existing law was basically for sex trafficking. And this included, as Liz defined it, this included both trafficking that involved force or coercion of a victim, as well as of an adult victim, as well as any sexual conduct with a person under the age of 18, which is considered to sort of be de facto coercive sexual behavior. So this law, this was already illegal under the federal law. It had been illegal since 2000, which with the passage of the trafficking for the TVPA, which I can never remember actually.
Trafficking Victims Protection Act.
Thank you. So it had already been a crime for a very long period of time. The original mandatory minimums were created in 2006 in a set of sort of very bad circumstances involving several very high-profile sex cases and rape cases that resulted in death that received huge headlines across the country. This year, Congress revisited that statute and decided to add three offenses. And one of those is soliciting a victim of trafficking, patronizing a victim of trafficking, or advertising a victim of trafficking. And these were problematic to us because on principle we oppose all mandatory minimums, even for the worst crimes. We think even when the crime is an unthinkable one, there will always be some circumstance we didn't think of, and we shouldn't have a one-size-fits-all approach to it. So we wrote a letter to Congress and we raised several concerns, and ultimately Congress passed it anyway. It passed 99 zip in the Senate. And over in the House, passed with only three no votes, which were very courageous. One was Bobby Scott, a Democrat from Virginia. He, like us, opposes all mandatory minimum sentences on principle. One was Thomas Massey, Republican from Kentucky, and I think probably has a pretty mean libertarian streak in him. And then the third one was John Conyers, the Democrat from Michigan. And we praised their vote, their no vote against the expanded mandatory minimum. And, you know, essentially the arguments we raised were that, you know, number one, the terms solicit and patronize were not defined in the statute. When there are 10 and 15 year mandatory minimums and you're going to take a decade of someone's life, I think you should be a little bit clearer about what you mean. I, for one, wrote in the letter, I said, I'm a lawyer, and I can't tell you what patronize means. I can think up a list of things it might mean, but I don't know for sure, and you don't tell me in the statute. And then the advertising mandatory minimum was also disturbing because you had to knowingly, you had to know that you were advertising a trafficked person, but there were a lot of situations where perhaps you could be talking about someone who is very tangentially connected at all with the activity in question. And we also sort of raised the question of, do you really want the IT guy to get the same 10-year mandatory minimum as the guy who's, you know, flying to Thailand, kidnapping women, bringing them back to the United States, keeping them in a basement, forcing them to be sex slaves? Maybe, maybe we don't. We can have a debate about that. But those were some of the objections we raised. And as I said, the expansions to the mandatory minimums did pass.
Okay. So while this law, you know, was passed at the federal level, there have been new laws against human trafficking all over the place. Some, you know, as we just talked about, the JVTA, there's numbers in states. And so I kind of wanted to ask Liz, like, can you tell us about how these new laws differ from laws that have been previously on the books at both the state and federal level, or if you just want to talk about the federal level, or just, you know, because I think it's confusing sometimes for people when they hear about these new laws against human trafficking, sex trafficking. I mean, Molly really did a good job of laying out all of sort of the problems with the JVTA, but people, you know, they don't understand, like, well, there's these new laws against human trafficking. Like, that must mean that there were never any laws against human trafficking before. I mean, as someone who's not familiar with how the government works, which is, you know, a little inefficiently, like, can you just explain how, you know, what has happened over the past couple of years?
So I just want to say that even before the first major trafficking act passed in 2000, the government could go after this sort of conduct at the state and federal level. At the federal level, using the Mann Act, which which bars transporting anyone over state lines for prostitution, the Tariff Act, which prevents using goods made from indentured labor or forced labor, various other statutes against indentured servitude, kidnapping, abduction, slavery, child sexual abuse, statutory rape, pandering. Those are all laws on the federal and state levels. So those laws were all used to prosecute the conduct that we are talking about. In 2000, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was passed, and I just kind of want to give you guys a brief history of how this has gone. So it was passed establishing these as specific crimes on their own in 2000, and it also set up an office to combat human trafficking at that time and expanded the penalties, or set the penalty ranges for these crimes. In its 2003 authorization, it upped the minimum penalties and maximum penalties. It allowed for federal wiretapping to be used to prosecute human traffickers. And it instituted a two strikes you're out rule requiring that mandatory life imprisonment upon a second sex offense involving a minor, unless the death penalty is opposed. The next reauthorization allowed to use federal racketeering laws to go after traffickers and to do asset forfeiture for traffickers. It added that people had to reduce demand for commercial sex acts, which is the patrons of people that are prostitution, that should be part of federal anti-trafficking policy. And it increased the funding, sometimes by 2- and 3-fold, for fighting persons who engage in the purchase of commercial sex acts. The next edition further expanded the penalties and further expanded the crimes, including obstructing a trafficking investigation that were counted as sex trafficking, and further doubled the appropriations. And the last reauthorization before this most recent law passed set up increased federal task forces to work on this. And that's all I got there. So as you can see, though, we have been sort of steadily ramping up the penalties for this for about 15 years now. And that's just at the federal level. The states have been doing the same thing. In 2014, 33 states passed new anti-trafficking laws. In this year alone so far, at least 22 have. Some of the trends that they have been doing have been because, like I said, or maybe I didn't say, but all 50 states have laws against human trafficking on the books already. So the things they're passing now are things like increasing the penalties, adding mandatory minimums, sometimes adding aggravating factors where if, you know, it takes place in certain distance of a school or whatever, then it's a bigger crime. A lot of states are giving police wiretapping capabilities, giving them grand juries. One state just passed so grand juries can prosecute these cases. So they're adding a lot of new ways that police can go after this. They're also adding a lot of things where people who are charged with trafficking can have their assets forfeited. And this includes the things like she was talking about, like people who advertise. And so it's kind of a broad range of conduct that's in any way associated can then be subject to civil asset forfeiture for this. And then one of the other, some of the other big things that the states have been doing too are adding any sex trafficking crimes to lists for which offenders have to apply and register on the sex offender list, and adding more penalties for people who solicit prostitution, which is, you know, kind of what people call johns sometimes, the clients of prostitution. And a lot of this doesn't really matter if the client knows that the person is trafficked or not, or knows the victim's age. So they're sort of adding them now. If you offer to pay for sex, then you are counted in this category of sex traffickers in a lot of these new state laws. 21 states so far have passed those sort of laws. So that's sort of where we've been heading. I think there's a lot of idea that people, that these things are not criminalized, but really they are criminalized. They've been criminalized for years, and we just keep ramping up the penalties and the prosecutorial power that we are giving people to go after them.
Okay, so now I have a question for you, finally, Katie. You know, now that we've kind of laid the groundwork and seen how these crimes have come about, how these penalties for these crimes have been ramped up over the past several decades, I kind of want to ask you a question about how does the focus on increasing policing of sex trafficking affect adults who are choosing to work in the sex industry? You know, people who are engaged in consensual sale of their bodies for sex.
Yeah, so I want to share just a couple stories. We've been throwing a lot of facts at you, and I think that putting kind of some personal faces on this would be helpful. The first way that has been most recently featured in the news is MasterCard and Visa coming out and saying that they will no longer allow their credit cards to be used to place ads on Backpage. So instead, now sex workers have to use Bitcoin to place ads on Backpage, which created a fantastic number of great YouTube videos about how to use Bitcoin for sex workers. So if you search these, they're really, really great. I highly recommend it. But what this has done...
Can you explain Backpage first for those who don't know?
Backpage is just, it's really like Craigslist, but very geared towards adult ads. So they're not even necessarily prostitution, but would include escorting, massage, all kind of ranges. Backpage, who we at Swap just love them, recently responded to this by saying, well, guess what? We're just going to make all adult ads free for the next 6 months. So kind of, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear, but like, screw you, Chicago. But screw you, Chicago. Because that's where the sheriff who introduced this was from Chicago. So that's kind of what has happened on a very large scale. You, in your introduction, mentioned the 16 women who were arrested for massage in Honolulu. This is also something we're seeing increasingly on a state-by-state level, is that women are being, not just women, but people more broadly are being arrested on sex work charges and then have these charges amplified to sexual assault. So while there's kind of this prevailing discourse of now looking at people engaged in sex work, and I'll get back to talking about that term in just a minute, they're originally being charged with sexual assault. And just to clarify, the sexual assault that they were charged with was sexual assault against the undercover officers who were soliciting massage from them in order to bust them for prostitution.
So which they said was in order to save them from sex trafficking,
right.
I think,
yes.
Was the like underlying premise there.
And so all of these women then were brought to the police station, charged with sexual assault 3, which includes mandatory sex offender registration, as well as prison time. And we're told, well, we are really interested in going after your trafficker. If you could tell us who your trafficker is, we'll make sure that you're hooked up with appropriate services. The problem is that those appropriate services, when we've looked at that more closely, just simply don't exist. And the best example of this is in New York City, they instituted a human trafficking court, very similar to a drug court, where now everyone who is arrested for prostitution, because again, you're starting to see this blurring of lines between anything that is differentiated from sex trafficking to sex work, is brought into court on a certain day and said, okay, you can either go through the problem-solving court or you can ask for a trial. If you go through the human trafficking court, you're sentenced to treatment, which includes anything from yoga sessions to individual counseling. And there's really no there's no evaluation that's done. It just happens to be like what treatment is being featured that day. The Red Umbrella Project in New York did a fascinating, huge report on this, and I highly recommend that everyone go home and read it. What they also found is that there were very limited resources for individuals who spoke a language other than English, and in fact, the only resource for individuals who were speaking either Cantonese or Mandarin was actually a church-based group. So they had to go through a church-based group in order to receive their court-ordered treatment. And the last story that I wanted to tell, kind of to conclude my parade of horrors here on how this has affected people, is a case out of Alaska that features a woman named Amber Batt. Amber Batt was running an escort business out of her home. She had about 32 different women who had signed independent contractor clauses who were working for her. She maintained a website and acted as a facilitator. So people would call her line. She would say, okay, who are you interested in seeing tonight? She would make the arrangement. She would also put up front the money for hotels, all of those sorts of things. She had all of these on file, and as a result, she also got a share of the profits. She ended up being charged under trafficking, and as one of the listed people, she was charged with trafficking herself because she actually was engaging in sex work herself. And so we're starting to see this now, that people who are engaging in sex work who don't have an obvious pimp or trafficker are also being charge themselves. The thing that I also want to add is that in Amber Batt's case, she was also paying for background checks on all 800 of the clients that she had on her books. So she was conducting extensive vetting of these individuals. I want to add that point because doing this type of vetting is very, very expensive and often is an additional cost. It's very hard to vet clients. And she was doing that if you were an independent contractor for her, and so the fee was, it was including those services. Now she has been arrested. She just agreed to a plea deal where she'll serve 4 to 7 years in prison and has already paid $15,000. She faces more fines as well as registration on the sex offender registry once she is released from prison. So.
Can I jump in here real quick? I'm really glad, that you brought some of that up, because as I was talking about the increased penalties, I know that that can kind of sound like, well, who cares if we're talking about people like the person, the mythological person who's, like sex trafficking people from Thailand and keeping them in his basement. But the people that are actually targeted under these laws are a lot of people like she has mentioned, and sex workers talk a lot about how, any one of them who help each other can be charged as a trafficker. One of the craziest things I've noticed this summer is, as we've said, anyone under 18 is defined as a de facto trafficking victim. Even if they don't have a pimp, even if there's no force, they are defined as they cannot consent. We've seen a few cases recently of federal trafficking charges against teenagers who are sex workers who have driven their other teenagers to jobs or recruited them to work with them. So we have 17-year-olds being charged as sex traffickers for recruiting 17-year-old friends to work with them. And that's, these are the people that are sometimes prosecuted under these laws. So.
Can I jump in real quick? I just would like to add to that. You had mentioned earlier that we don't have good research around youth engaged in sex work. That's actually not true anymore. We do. And the Department of Justice actually funded it. They funded it under a provision to fund anti-trafficking research. The problem was that it didn't find what they wanted it to find. So I want to make a huge shout out here to Rick Curtis at CUNY, one of one of the unis, who did this research and actually interviewed 294 street-involved youth who were engaging in commercial sex work. And I wrote the numbers down so I'm because I wanted to be absolutely sure that I got them right. They interviewed 294 individuals who were engaged in street-based sex work at a commercial level who were under the age of 18. And what they found is that the vast majority, over half, were recruited by friends, not by a pimp or trafficker. In fact, just 19% of the total sample said that they had been recruited by a pimp or trafficker. And the majority of those individuals were no longer working for that person. When asked who was actually working for a pimp or market facilitator at the time, that number actually was 14% for women, 3% for men or boys, and 0% of trans youth who they interviewed. So what I want to stress is, when we think of sex work, we often talk about it in sex worker rights as being on this continuum with kind of a small group of individuals who are really engaging in choice, like sex work by choice on one side, sex work by coercion on the other. But the majority of people really fall in this middle area, this gray area of being there because of circumstance, because of lack of employment opportunities, because of transphobia, because of homelessness, because of involvement in the foster care system, even among youth. And when we divert so many resources to addressing that small group who is in sex work or being sexually exploited, we are really just ignoring everyone in the middle. I'll conclude my monologuing there.
Yeah, that was great. Molly, so I want to ask you a question, because you've been working for FAM for a while, and you've seen all sorts of new mandatory minimum, either suggestions pop up or actual laws passed in a number of states and at the federal level. So it's sadly sort of become a routine for you at this point. So I just wanted to ask and just get your insight into how do these mandatory minimums come about? Why are we always seeing new mandatory minimums proposed? Why does that happen?
Well, I'm glad we have alcohol in the building, because this makes a great drinking game, actually. Not even joking. Not that I'm if you're underage, I'm not encouraging you to drink. So at our website, we have a complete list of all the federal mandatory minimum sentences. If you ever want bedtime reading, this is also a fantastic resource. Although some of this stuff is just really fun. And we have the statute listed, and then the crime, and then the year it was created. And pretty much uniformly, if you go through this list, you can decide what... you can figure out why the mandatory minimum was created based on the date that it was created. So we'll just play a couple, and maybe I'll have to get you shots afterwards. Okay, so 1986, we have the creation of our federal mandatory minimum drug sentencing laws. Any guesses as to the historical event that precipitated the creation of those? War on drugs, you children of the 80s. Come on, get with me here. So 1986, we have a very famous college basketball student named Len Bias who goes out. He overdoses on powder cocaine when he's drafted and is out partying and celebrating. He overdoses. He dies. It makes national headlines the next morning. Senator Tip O'Neill, huge Boston Celtics fan, is devastated that he will no longer be a Celtic, and flies down to Washington, D.C., gets on the floor of Congress, and a few months before an election says, we need to crack down on this horrible crack cocaine that is killing our children and this horrible drug epidemic that we have going on in America. Voila, October 27th, 1986, very suspiciously close to an election day, Congress passes our mandatory minimum drug sentencing laws, which we still have 30 years later today. Some more fun ones in here. 1934, creation of a 10-year mandatory minimum for causing death while fleeing a bank robbery. Any takers on this one? 1934, Bonnie and Clyde had their crime spree. So it works every single time. 1964, we create a mandatory minimum for assassinating a president.
Real deterrence there.
These ones are really fun. These are some of my favorites. 1790, piracy on the high seas. When we were a small fledgling country, we had a serious problem with the Barbary pirates, and the Congress decided they were going to take this seriously and create mandatory minimums for these, for piracy. So those are some of our oldest mandatory minimum sentencing laws. And you know, I talked about the, you know, 2006 was the year that we created our mandatory minimums for human sex trafficking. That was a terrible year. There were several, as I mentioned, very high profile, headline grabbing deaths of young women who had been sexually assaulted and killed. I remember it very memorably because at the time I was working in a prosecutor's office in Minneapolis, and one of those deaths was a woman named Drew Shadeen. I was 24, Drew Shadeen was 22. It's basically sort of every parent's horror story. Drew Shadeen was kidnapped from a parking lot by a registered sex offender, taken out, raped, killed. Her body was found and they discovered who had killed her. There was a lot of talk in the prosecutor's office I was working in as to whether Minnesota would prosecute it or North Dakota would. Ultimately, it became a federal case because they wanted to apply the death penalty to him, and that's exactly what happened. So part of the Adam Walsh Child Protection Act, which created the mandatory minimums for this crime, included a provision called Drew's Law. Anytime you have, Bobby Scott, a Democrat from Virginia, will often say this, anytime you have a law with a victim's, that begins with a victim's name, if you're a member of Congress, you better not vote against that law. We are actually seeing this today. I have a modern day example that is happening as we speak. There's now a Kate's Law effort in Congress. This is stemming from the tragic death of Kate Steinle in San Francisco not too long ago by a person who was in the country illegally. And there are three bills that would do this. They would create a 5-year mandatory minimum for illegal reentry to the United States. These bills were introduced without hearings, without testimony, without any kind of look at the evidence or data or the effectiveness of our illegal reentry laws. And there's basically a huge political wind behind the back of this effort. And of course, FAM is opposing it because we think that we need to take smarter approaches that have individualized justice.
So I guess this will be my final question before we open it up to Q&A. But we've spent a lot of time talking about the unintended consequences on, you know, legal sex, not legal, but consenting adults, sex workers, and talking about the unintended consequences of mandatory minimum sentences in general. But I just wanted to ask maybe Katie or anybody else who wants to answer, you know, are some of these laws that are being passed, are they helping sex trafficking, actual victims of sex trafficking? Because I want to reiterate that we are not saying that human trafficking isn't an issue. It is. It does happen. And so I want to ask you guys, do some of these laws actually harm sex trafficking victims? Do they help them? What kind of effect do they have on real victims of sex trafficking?
I would say that from an evidence-based perspective, we simply have no evidence showing that these laws are helping at this point, which is problematic in and of itself. They've been on the books at this point long enough that we should at least have some evidence, and what we do have suggests that there is no difference for individuals who go through these programs versus those who are arrested and go through prison, which suggests that they're certainly not helping. What we know just from stories of SWAP members is that being in these programs can actually lead to more consequences. And I'll leave you just with a story that Rick Curtis and his research team again found, which was that of young girls who did have a pimp, what they found is that a large number of them actually were recruited by their pimp from a program such as this. So that traffickers that do exist in the very scary way that we think of traffickers are aware of these programs and actually are using them to identify people who are vulnerable, which I think is probably the biggest argument against using them. So.
You wanna?
I just want to say that, you know, Shared Hope International, which is one of the big anti-trafficking organizations, they did a study looking at police stings to try and catch people who were buying sex. And they found that almost half of them involved no actual victims. So almost half of the sex trafficking stings that they were convicted doing involved no victims. They just involved police who pretended to be an adult sex worker. Once a man agreed to meet them, they said, actually, I'm underage. The man still came. They arrested them. This is what we have a lot of our police resources going to. 50 to 60% of these stings are conducted like that. It was in select cities, but I mean, this is happening in a lot of them. Meanwhile, if you talk to people who are working really closely with victims of sex trafficking, or maybe just people who are in sex work but do not totally want to be there, the biggest thing stopping them from either getting out of prostitution or from escaping people who are forcing them into it is that they just don't have anywhere to go, and they don't have any resources. There are nowhere near enough emergency beds at shelters. Police do not take them seriously when they come. They try to arrest them for prostitution instead. They go to court and they want to get help finding a job, and they send them to yoga classes. So I think that in the way that we're diverting all of these resources to this sort of super intense law enforcement, law and order crime aspect, we're really neglecting like the things that are very important for actually helping victims.
Okay, and with that, I guess we will conclude the discussion aspect of this. So I want to give our panelists a round of applause if we can.